Today is November 16th, 1999. We're at Michigan State University, East Lansing, Michigan. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Professor Pauline Adams for the Michigan State University Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution to be celebrated in the year 2005. Professor Adams, as you know, you can see we're tape recording today. You give us permission to tape?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to start out with some questions about your early impressions of Michigan State when you first came. Today is November 16th, 1999. We're at Michigan State University, East Lansing, Michigan. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Professor Pauline Adams for the Michigan State University Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution to be celebrated in the year 2005. Professor Adams, as you know, you can see we're tape recording today. You give us permission to tape?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to start out with some questions about your early impressions of Michigan State when you first came. What's your educational background and obviously professional background? Where'd you go to school?
I went as an undergraduate to Brooklyn College, and I did my graduate work, which was a master's degree at Columbia University in the economics department, where I concentrated on economic history.
Okay.
And then I took some more postgraduate courses at Yale University.
Okay.
Again, in economic history.
Mm-hmm. And what years were those?
Okay. I graduated from Brooklyn College in 1942. I graduated from Columbia in 1945. And then I was at Yale from 46 to 47.
47, I see. So during the war years, you were in
New York City.
New York City, okay.
And I lived at home during all my college experiences.
Okay.
So I never had a dorm experience.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew what it was to live at college or live away from home.
Mm-hmm. Gave a little different perspective.
A different perspective. So I've been a sophomore ever since.
How was it that you came to Michigan State? What were the circumstances?
Well, in those days, a woman accompanied her husband, and my husband's first job outside of his graduate teaching at Yale was at Michigan State. So we came here in 1947, mm-hmm. August of 47.
Had you been to Michigan before?
Never.
And never here?
Never here. I had really never been outside of New York except for the 2 years we lived in New Haven, Connecticut when we were at Yale.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So.
And anything you remember that of those early days that was striking about west of the Hudson?
Oh, yes, a lot. When we arrived, we drove. It took us 3 days to get here from New York City. There were no superhighways then.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a ferry, left Buffalo on an overnight ferry, and then disembarked at Detroit, and then drove up, I guess, Grand River all the way from Detroit,
mm-hmm.
and arrived here, I remember, on a Sunday. We were assigned an apartment in Cherry Lane, the brick apartments, we call them,
mm-hmm.
801 Cherry Lane.
You remember the exact apartment?
Oh, yes, because I am still a member of a bridge group of women from 801 Cherry Lane, so I won't
forget
it. The same, well, it started out that way, but there's mm-hmm. been attrition along the way and
mm-hmm.
replacements. But I'm the only original member of that group. We were first tenants. The building did not have bricks on the building yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was they called it a three-room apartment. It was really two rooms because
mm-hmm.
it was a bedroom. And there was a living room and a tiny kitchen that you couldn't eat in. And that was the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a child at that time. And we gave him the bedroom. And we slept on a pull-out couch in the living room. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the bathroom, whoever designed that apartment, did a lousy job. The bathroom was on the other side of the bedroom. So having a child who was a light sleeper, if for the first hour or two that he was asleep, we didn't dare go into the bathroom if we needed to. Mm-hmm. And this was very hard on us.
The ultimate sacrifice.
Right.
When you first came, were you teaching here, or was...
Actually, the first year I was here, I did teach in one quarter. Mm-hmm. I taught in the humanities department, or I think it was called History of Civilization then.
Okay.
And I did teach a course in the winter quarter. Mm-hmm. Tom Greer, was on leave. I didn't take his place, but I took his classes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I did teach that one quarter. Mm-hmm. But that was all until I started teaching in this department.
Mm-hmm. When you first arrived, how was the campus different as you remember it?
Oh, it was very different. It was very different from what it is today. Mm-hmm. It was very different from New York City. Mm-hmm. It was very different from even New Haven.
In what ways would you say?
Well, the day we arrived was warm. Our furniture hadn't come yet. And I remember I thought, well, to make supper, I'll go out to the store and get some vegetables and some sour cream and just make a salad. For supper. There was a little store that was run by the Prince brothers, where I think there are no buildings there now. It was right on, what's the name of that? Kalamazoo and Harrison.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I went into this little store and I asked for some sour cream. And you wouldn't believe what the clerk said to me. He said, "Lady, all our cream is fresh." Well, I knew I was in a different culture. I knew that this was a different world. And even little things like that, it took a little while. Our apartment, as I say, we were the first tenants there, and our apartment had an apartment-sized stove. It was an electric stove with three burners on the top. Mm-hmm. One of them didn't work. So I called the housing manager, and I said, you know, this is a new stove, but it's defective. I suggest you return it and get a fully operating stove. And he said, "I'll be right over." And he came over. And he said to me, "Have you ever cooked on an electric stove before?" And actually, I hadn't. We had a gas stove in the East. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, no." And I was going to tell him it was a gas stove. And he said to me, "That's the trouble with all you Southerners. You only know wood-burning stoves." Well, I mean, it was a very different world than it is today. Mm-hmm. We were the first group of faculty who came from outside Michigan. The university was expanding into a university, from a college into a university, and it was called Michigan State College at that time. Mm-hmm. And the feel was completely different. And we were foreigners and we were strangers, and it was very different. Mm-hmm.
And so the World War II, the generation that went through and fought World War II, did your husband use the GI Bill when he went to...
to graduate school.
Graduate school,
With the GI Bill.
So you were part of that.
Oh, yes, oh, yes.
Influx of large numbers of students and faculty alike.
Absolutely, and many of the students were GI Bill recipients. Mm-hmm. They were veterans. Yeah.
Did you notice a difference, even in that first class that you teach? I know it's been a long time since then, but attitudes of students on campus toward either their studies or the university as a whole or college? Did you see any qualitative differences?
If I'm honest, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've always loved teaching. I always enjoy being in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember any particular problems mm-hmm. with the students. But it was only a one-quarter experience.
Okay.
And I really don't remember the mm-hmm. student body that well.
Mm-hmm. When did you first begin teaching in American Thought and Language?
In 1956.
In 56, okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 56.
And the course...
It wasn't called American no. Thought and Language then.
Right.
And we were over, our classes were over in Quonset Huts mm-hmm. on the South Campus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the curriculum mission at that time, was it teaching writing or was it a variety of...
It was teaching reading, writing, listening, speaking.
Okay.
And I think it was called communication skills. Mm-hmm. And those were the four dimensions. And I must say, it was a very disappointing program. I mean, I thought it was a very weak curriculum. Mm-hmm.
And it was a centrally designed and
yes,
people teach
everything.
From a common syllabus?
Yes, a common syllabus, mm-hmm. common tests. It was there was practically no leeway for the individual instructor, mm-hmm. and the students took it very lightly, mm-hmm. and I don't think they got much out of it. Mm-hmm.
And that changed at some point.
Yes, it changed. We got a new chairperson, Blackman, Ed Blackman, mm-hmm. and he had the conception of a body of material from which we would work. And that body of material, that core of common material, was chosen to be American Studies. Mm-hmm. And so the whole, for me, it was late in coming, but it was a wonderful, miraculous change mm-hmm. from what had been. Theoretically, the old syllabus, the old course sounded great, you know, we'll teach them how to read and write and speak and listen. Mm-hmm. But of course, the whole thing was a farce.
Mm-hmm. Were the class sizes large at that time?
As I recall, yes, they were in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And we met through, let's see, we had a common section where we would where all our sections would meet together one day a week mm-hmm. in addition to the individual sections.
I see.
I'm trying to recall what we did on that one common session.
Did they bring in guest speakers or?
No.
Oh, it was okay.
No,
right.
No.
I see.
No. And it was, there was a text that they used and I thought it was a very poorly designed course as far as being effective. But you may get faculty here who thought it was excellent. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. Did you, in those early years, were there any faculty, any of your colleagues that you worked closely with in your teaching? Or?
Not initially. I didn't. I spent little time on campus. I would come in, teach my course, and then go home and do my grading and et cetera at home. Mm-hmm. Office space was very limited. When we were over in the Quonset Huts before Bessie Hall was mm-hmm. built. We had a common office. There must have been four or five instructors in the same office. Well, you know, that's very difficult to do anything, to do your own work, mm-hmm. to interview or have conferences with students. It was very limiting. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of my own work preparation, et cetera, at home.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a favorite text that you've used over the years that worked well or that students responded to? Did you have any favorite one that worked well?
No, I think when we started on the American Thought and Language, when we started on the American Studies core mm-hmm. for our, we had a lot, we were given several books to help prepare us to teach that, something like Horton and Edwards and others that were very helpful. And our text I'm trying to think the anthology that we used. Do you remember the name?
Was it the Norton Anthology or
no.
It was a different one?
No, it was a different one. Uh-huh. I have it at home. It was excellent. Okay. Very good. And I've always believed that that course that came in to replace the original communication skills did as much for the faculty as it did for the students, mm-hmm. because it rounded out the faculty in their background, and so that they even began to do research and write in a field that they may not have gotten their advanced degrees in. And it broadened them so. It did so much for the faculty, I believe, that it was wonderful. And I wish I could remember the anthology we used, but it was a very good anthology and very instructive, wonderful to teach. Mm-hmm. But we used very little outside reading mm-hmm. in addition to that anthology. And in the early days, we still had a common exam. Mm-hmm. Which in a way was unfortunate, because if you are concentrating on writing, which we were, to have an exam that was a common exam based on the reading materials, that counted 50% of your grade,
wow.
accounted 50% of the grade, left very little room for the individual teacher and the impact of teaching, mm-hmm. I mean of writing mm-hmm. on the, so, but then it changed. Okay. It changed in the late 60s as a result of student rebellion.
You saw direct cause and effect?
Oh yeah, oh, well,
to the large classes,
every university in the country saw, oh yeah. Yes. And then we went off into all different areas, and instructors were allowed much greater freedom in choosing what, and the instructor was given the full power of grade giving, mm-hmm. Which is where it belongs.
That had been lacking before.
Well, because 50% of the grade automatically was that common exam. Mm-hmm. So yep. the instructor had just a minimal impact, really, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. which is unfortunate.
Were there any areas of your own research and scholarly interest that you incorporated in those years and in the 70s?
Into the teaching?
Yes, that you developed an interest?
Well, I'm trying to think, because most of my research and most of my writing was done, it was sort of parallel, but outside the course we were teaching. It all had to do with American studies in mm-hmm. one way or another. But it wasn't directly related to what I would. For instance, the book that I wrote together with Jerry Thornton, A Populist Assault, Sarah E. Vandervoort Emery on American Democracy, 1862-1895. I never even mentioned her in my class, mm-hmm. although one quarter I did use it. Mm-hmm. Because it fitted into the my concept of the way I set up the class. Mm-hmm. I always tried to change. Every year I changed a good part of my syllabus just to gratify myself.
Mm-hmm. How did students respond to the text?
They didn't like it. No, they didn't like it. They thought it was too boring. They wanted to read some light novel that they could be entertained by. Yeah.
Did you find that any of your in this text, did you find your training as an economist helped you at all in understanding her ideas? Or
well, that's one reason I got. I'm not an economist.
Well,
it was economic history,
which is that's right.
And any economist would tell you that's not being an economist.
That's true.
So yes, because she was a populist and she was mainly concerned with the economy. Mm-hmm. And she was a monetarist, an early monetarist. And of course, Milton Friedman, the great modern contemporary, and I use great in quotation marks, mm-hmm. Economist, looked to the populace, and he recognized them and acknowledged them as the source of his whole monetarist theory. So that, yes, my background in economic history helped me very much in understanding what she was writing, why she was writing it, and what the implications of her writings were.
Mm-hmm. How did you first get interested in her?
Well, it was an interesting thing. When Bessie Hall went up and we got offices, many of us still shared an office. Now, if you can picture our tiny offices mm-hmm. with
two people
in it, the person that I had as my office mate was Jerry Thornton. And we, instead of killing each other off, we helped each other, discussed what we were working on, etc. And Jerry retired long before I did. And she belonged to the Unitarian Church. And she had found in the church the records of this woman, Sarah Vandervoort Emery, whose papers were in the church archives. And she said, "Pauline, I'd like to work," I said, "on this woman." I said, "Great, why don't you do that? You're retired, now you can do it." And she started. And then she called me and she said, "Look, there's too much economics here. I need some help." And Jerry and I had complementary minds. I had a more logical, organized mind. She had a poetic mind and very imaginative. And we worked very well together. As a matter of fact, we collaborated on many different articles together. And so she wanted me to join her to work on all the different writings of this woman. And I could only work with her in the summer because during the academic year, what with all the paper grading and everything else, and having a life beyond Michigan State as well, I only worked in the summer, so it took us a long time working on that. I think we worked on that for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. But that certainly helped me. But then we did a lot of other things. For instance, Jerry was so taken with our experience as collaborators that she wanted to do something on collaboration. And we did some research on collaboration as a style of doing research and writing, mm-hmm. and interviewed lots of people on that. And we did a couple of articles on that, and I was interested in other things that we worked on together, and I also worked with John Apple. We did a couple of things, and I worked with Marilyn Culpepper. We gave joint papers at various meetings. So that it was all some way related to the course, related to American studies, but didn't get into the course that I taught, mm-hmm. if I make that distinction.
I see, I understand. This issue of collaboration, I think, is a key one. Scholars working together. I mean,
it
goes against the grain of the perception of the solitary scholar up in Ivory Tower. And also looking at your husband's writings.
He does a lot of collaboration.
I think that's an important, maybe important thread that maybe some people haven't looked at. In terms of the actual collaboration that you did with Jerry Thornton and Marilyn Culpepper and others. Looking at the writing process that as you did that, how did was one person responsible for a first draft, or how did you organize for that?
Well, actually, that's the question that's always asked of a collaborator, isn't it? Like, who wrote what, and how did you do it? Mm-hmm. My personal experience with my three collaborators, John Apple, Marilyn Culpepper, and Jerry Thornton, each experience was completely different mm-hmm. from the other. And the process was different. Mm-hmm. When we were gathering material for the little article that Jerry and I wrote on collaboration, and I interviewed many people from different disciplines, each person's experience and attitude was different. But what we discovered as we wrote, if I remember correctly, in that article, is that the discipline they came from also had an impact on the experience. For instance, we found people from the English department thought that collaborate writing was sort of dishonest, that if they didn't do it themselves, if they didn't write alone, that it really wasn't a true form of research and accomplishment. They had to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. People in the sciences said they always wrote in collaboration, and that if you pick up a scientific article, you see a whole host of authors mm-hmm. of that article. In the social sciences, there was increasing emphasis on collaboration because of, as in the sciences, increasing specialization, so that no one person could really cover different aspects of a topic because they were so highly specialized, the individual. On a personal level, the experience was very different, too. Some people never saw their collaborators. The publishers would put together a group asking people, hiring people from their various parts of the country to work on a text for such and such.
I see.
And some of them never met their collaborators at all. Mm-hmm. And they were just given an assignment by a publishing house.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their contribution to that text. So the experience was so varied and brought with it varying forms of gratification. Some loved the experience, and it was very meaningful to them on a personal level, mm-hmm. aside from the scholarly level. And others disliked it immensely.
Mm-hmm. What did you work on with John Apple? Do you remember?
Yes, it was a review article of immigrant tapes. And we did it for some publication that dealt with immigration, the history of immigration.
Oh,
and we would listen to these tapes together. And then, I can't remember exactly, one of us would write up what we heard, our reaction to it and a summary of it, and then give it to the other. Mm-hmm. And then that person would edit it or change it. And then it would go back to the original writer and then become part of them. That's what we did. We did two articles.
The tapes were immigrants' own experiences?
It was oral history.
Okay.
Oral histories mm-hmm. of immigrants who came over from all over the world.
I see.
Yeah, and under all different circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And with Marilyn Culpepper, your...
Marilyn Culpepper, I did several things on. We did something on oral history. We did interviewing older women in their 80s in the area.
Was there a topical focus of that?
Well, you know, the way I like to work in oral history may be against the form because it's a little undisciplined. I'd like to have a series of questions that I ask them. But if the interviewee starts taking off on a train of thought, I just let them go. Mm-hmm. I don't restrict them. So it's more difficult to write it up
mm-hmm.
Because you can't say, well, three people said this
right.
and 10 people said that and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But we did some oral history together. We also did an article on diaries and letters from the Civil War. And particularly, we did one article on nurses and nursing during the Civil War, based on these letters. And we also did a couple of articles on diaries of women that we got from the state archives. And we compared and contrasted them. One was a school teacher, another was a woman who worked in Lansing in a bakery mm-hmm. in the latter part of the 19th century, post-Civil War period.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what we worked on, and other things as well. Mm-hmm. And with that's it, essentially.
Mm-hmm. The poetry that Jerry Thornton, did you write any poetry with her, or
no,
did she?
No, she was the poet. Mm-hmm. I did work with her. We wrote a very interesting article on her grandfather, who was an original homesteader in Minnesota, and he wrote for that local newspaper that was put out in the latter part of the 19th century. And we went over all the articles from the newspaper, and we did an article on that. And I worked with her on that. It was very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we did a lot of things together on the way, and I frankly can't remember them. I don't remember. I should have my bibliography here, or my vita.
Let's see. I guess I've answered a lot of my questions. All right. We turn the page a little bit toward talking about some of the presidents that you worked with, and I also want to talk a little bit about the experience that you had when your husband was president of the university. But you remember any of your first contact with John Hanna?
Well, yes. The university was much smaller when we came. And every year, at the beginning of the academic year, Hanna would have a reception for the faculty at the Union Building. And he would stand in a receiving line and welcome each person in the faculty. He took a very personal interest in those early days of his faculty members. And that was the first time I met him. We arrived near the end of August, and in September was that